This podcast is a part of the Newhoff Media Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Stylescast. I am Wes Styles on Twitter and Instagram, Wes Styles Radio. And speaking of both those outlets, my guest today, he is known as Latin Metal. On both of them, Christian Machado joins me right now. And brother, thank you, one, for the time. And what an exciting time for you, because you got some new music coming out.
Man, I'm trying to stay creative in these crazy, crazy times, Wes. And thank you so much for having me, dude. I'm honored to be even talking with you, man.
Well,
we're trying to stay alive out here, trying to make music, stay alive. Hopefully we get to tour eventually sometime.
Yeah, I know. We were just talking before this interview about how, you know, the touring situation is kind of in flux, if you will, at this point. But, you know, the big thing right now, you got this brand new record coming out. And I really want to dive into this, but I want to start with, you know, I mean, and I don't want to start on a dark thing, but the exit from El Nino was a very documented thing, so we're not going to go into that. But when that all went down, did you ever think that that was going to be the end for you in terms of your musical journey?
I did for a moment.
Okay.
You know, I did for a moment. I'd be lying if I didn't say, you know, it was an extremely dark time. You know, I didn't know where my career was going at all. I was blessed to have a record label reach out to me and want to work with me during the time that the situation was occurring. But for sure, you know, a lot of times I said, what's going to occur? I mean, am I going to continue with music? Are my fans even going to care if I do something? You know, is the band going to continue? Am I going to be in the band or not? You know, but I think ultimately, I'm terrible at holding grudges. I'm terrible at holding grudges, man. And I think it was the best for me to kind of just see this as an opportunity to start over again, you know, and maybe have things work a little bit more to my advantage rather than always having so much concern. You know, being in a band is not as easy as everybody thinks. And the more that it becomes business, the more that, you know, people in the band have different opinions and feel differently about things. And, you know, I'm just blessed I got to write some music and that I'm getting to release it, man. It's a terrible time for the world, but I think some of the songs that I have on this record may make some sense in the big scheme of what's going on. I mean, they're really personal songs written from a very dark place, hopefully looking at towards the light somehow. But for sure, I wrote them in an extremely dark place in my life, man. I mean, if it weren't for my fans and the friends that I have, you know, even you guys and even the communication that we have online and just, you know, joking with each other, it really has kept me out of depression. Music and friends have kept me out of depression without a doubt.
That's awesome to hear. Well, with this new album, this is a very I appreciate that the fact that you sent me a couple tracks, but you know, it's a very different side of you from what fans know, and you almost label it kind of like dark acoustic metal. What took you this direction?
I've always been a very broad fan of music. I've always liked a little bit of everything. You know, the opportunity was presented to me to make a solo album. I didn't see myself making a full band thing. I would love, you know, in my mind, I would love to hold that for the other things that Diego and Aru, who were also in El Nino, are working on. And eventually we'll do some rock stuff, but I didn't really want to go into this world of a solo artist and then it's like my band or something. I wanted to just write music. You know, I really just wanted to be as pure as possible. I'm not thinking about a band. I'm not thinking about how this is going to be produced. I want to sit down with my acoustic guitar and write some songs and tell stories. And that's really kind of where it came from. You know, the opportunity was presented to me by Jeff Lanier, who's a label manager at Chesky Records. And Chesky Records is a great Latin jazz and contemporary jazz label that has worked with like Macy Gray and McCoy Tyner, and they've put out Miles Davis albums. And, you know, Jeff presented it to me, and this felt like the most natural thing. I think anything else would have felt like I'm trying a little bit too hard. And I know this is different than what I've done, but hopefully the melodic element in my former band maybe leads into this a little bit.
Okay. You mentioned the label and what the artists that they have done and worked with, and obviously this is a different side of you musically. What was the attractiveness to this particular label? Because you're an imprint of them as well with Chesky Records, to go that route and sign with them for this release.
The thing that attracted me the most is it's definitely outside of my world. I've always liked good challenges. I've never been one to just try to get really comfortable in what I'm doing and just staying there. If anything, many times in my life, I felt trapped musically because of that situation, felt trapped, you know, in love because of situations and things like that. So to me, it was like this challenge. They're a completely different label. They work with artists that really focus on music or coming from a song element, not so much a production element. And they're an audiophile label. That was the thing that interested me the most, is all our songs are not just going to be released, you know, regular MP3 quality on all the streaming formats, but they're also going to be released at 192 sample rate. We recorded the whole album at 192. It's the highest sample rate you could use, but they're going to be released as audiophile tracks on HD tracks, which is the, you know, the largest audiophile distributor, digital distributor that exists. That to me was so cool, you know, because I'm kind of like an audio engineer, somewhat of an audio geek. And, you know, it gave me a little bit to kind of look forward to from that element. I remember even in metal, you know, when the bands that have made the most difference in metal, or the bands that have really been life-affirming bands to so many fans, they had somewhat of an audio kind of thing to them. You know, it was the songs, and then whether, you know, the sound evolved a little bit, or the sound got clearer or more distorted, there's always a little something to it. So from an audio geek point of view, I thought the audiophile thing is cool. And at least we'll offer fans different tiers of how to listen to music. You know, if you really like clear music and as best sounding as possible, this is definitely for you, you know. And if you just like MP3s, you know, it'll also sound great as an MP3, but mostly feeling challenged and then, you know, having an audiophile quality about it, I thought was interesting and would at least benefit songs, maybe. In my head, at least that's what I felt.
All right, well, talk to me about the recording of the record, because I saw on your Instagram, and I quote, apparently the label got us a penthouse in Brooklyn. You did the album the old school way, not multi-tracking, no audio tricks, just great songs and raw talent. So all that encompassed, talk to me about those two quotes there.
Okay, so the label, Chesky Records, they don't traditionally do productions the way, you know, you would go into the studio and everybody plays everything individually and you punch in 50 million times to get it done. That's not the way this label works, because they're a contemporary label and they work with amazing talent, jazz talent that doesn't need more than one take to do it. They like to have that be their niche, you know? So all the music was recorded through two microphones, left and right. Nobody was individually mic'd. And then there was a vocal mic that was separate, and then my acoustic guitar went in separately. So the entire thing was done through four mics, and it was all done live. We did multiple takes of each song. There were very tiny edits made. For example, the solo was better on take three than take one, so we used the entire solo piece from take three. But there was no punching in anybody. Everybody had to play it tight together, you know. And when you have a situation like that, there is no way to edit that, unless you're saying like, okay, this chorus is better than that other chorus. It's basically the old school way. When they used to record back in the day, bands would do that, you know. They would record live and then they would just pick the best chorus, you know, the best verse. Mm-hmm. And that's really all that was done. It wasn't much more than a couple of mics and get it right.
So for you being in a band who used to, and I'm sure you did, everybody would come in and do their part on a particular day, then you're done, and the next person comes in and does the same thing. How was that for you walking into that studio and being in that environment?
It was without a doubt the most challenging thing I've ever done musically in my entire career, Wes. Without a doubt. It was, you know, we're pampered. As rock musicians, we are so pampered. And I mean, some people are, you know, just amazing talents that they could, you know, Celine Dion could walk behind a mic and do one take and that's it, you know, and that's all you need and that's all she needs to do. But as rock musicians, almost throughout the years, you become pampered because you go into studio, the drummer goes first, you know, and then they fix some things, and then the bass player goes and they fix some things, and the guitar player goes. And so this was the most challenging thing I've ever done. Me and the guitar player, Gonzalo and Steve, we, you know, we had to have like 2 months of rehearsing before we went to New York. And it was, we were doing about 3 days a week, 6 hour days, and just going through the songs. The bass player and the violin player, Junior and Ali, and Oscar, the percussion player, met us in New York. And then we did a couple of days of pre-pro with them there, but all the songs were written in California, hence why the album's Hollywood and Sycamore. That's technically the corner we jammed on. And, you know, we did everything live. It was extremely challenging, man. And, you know, some first takes were terrible. And on the second day, we had to come back. I think on the second day, we came back and we scratched about two of the songs that we did on the first day. And we had to redo them all over again after listening back and saying, okay. It definitely felt like the longer you're in a studio and if you're prepared, the more you're in a room with really great musicians, all you really need is a little bit of time to get it perfect. It can be done live. It can be recorded naturally. You don't need 24 microphones. It's just a preparation thing, and everybody's mind has to be feeling that, you know. But for me, it was incredibly challenging. I'm not going to lie, man. It was fun, and it was so much. That's what I think was the best, most beneficial thing is what I've learned. You know, it's invaluable. So valuable.
Okay. Hollywood and Sycamore, that's going to come out in September, correct?
Yes, coming out in September, yeah.
Okay, and Die Alone's going to be the first single. We'll see that on May 8th, right?
Yes, coming out on May 8th, and, you know, we'll be pitching to multiple formats, so hopefully, you know, maybe it'll get on the air, which eventually maybe.
Well, I was reading that you said that it may be this song, Die Alone, may be one of the best ones you've ever written. And I've always heard from musicians that picking a favorite song is like picking your favorite child. So why does this one stand out?
It was, you know, it was the easiest song that I've ever put together in my entire life. From the, you know, it took about a half a day to write, and it took about 2 hours to record. And I think it was the most perfect song that I could have written without putting too much thought into it.
Okay.
And, I think it's got a great chorus. It tells a story, it's genuine. And it felt like it came from a real honest place, you know. I've been through somewhat of a nightmare the last couple of years, but I think it can connect with a lot of people, and hopefully it will. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I definitely think
I'm not expecting much. I know it's the music industry is extremely complicated and challenging, you know. Mm-hmm. But all you could do is just try to put forth your best material at that moment, you know.
Well, it's definitely got some good and honest lyrics. This album mixes some originals with covers. You got Post Malone's "Blame It on Me," "Life of Agony," "Weeds." You also got "Welcome to the Machine" from Pink Floyd. So, what went into picking the particular covers that you chose for this record?
Well, I'm a huge Pink Floyd fan. I've always been. It's always been one of those bands that you know, you don't cover. Like, it's one of those bands like Faith No More. It's like you don't cover Faith No More. You know, mm-hmm. You don't cover Pink Floyd. You wouldn't cover Tool. You know, but some people do it. I don't know. But they're one of my favorite bands, and I thought "Welcome to the Machine" was one of the greatest most modern songs at the time. You know, listening to it back now, they were so ahead of time with what they were doing as far as programming and synth sounds that it just felt challenging. You know, from a rocker point of view, it's just an extremely dark song. And, you know, the dark lyricist in me has always had that side of me that looks at society as this, you know, prison system that you may or may not break out of depending on how you feel about your life. And that song totally defined that, I felt.
That's a cool look at it. There's also a couple of reworkings of tracks from your previous band. Which ones are on the record and what went into picking those ones?
We got How Can I Live on there, okay, which is one of the singles we had back in the day, and also Numb. And I think the process of picking the Nino songs to put on there really came down to which songs really have great melody. You know, I didn't want a song sticking out on the album. Every single song on the album, all the melody is really, really good. And I wanted to be able to put a couple songs that I can maybe grow on a little bit, not do exactly what was on the album, but that's got enough of the melodic content there that I can grow and change some things and feel creative about it, I think was the main thing. You know, it's a selfish thing to say that, but it was mostly like, oh, well, I want to feel like we did something with this, you know?
Right.
But I think they'll work. I think, you know, they sound amazing, both of those songs. I think the El Nino fans will be happy.
Well, that's all that matters. And plus, for you as the artist who was there to write those tracks and be a part of them, I mean, to grow it and to see them become something different, that definitely is important to you as well.
Sure, sure. At least it gives you a little bit of musical growth, and like, it's all for a reason, mm-hmm. You know? You never want to feel trapped in music the same. With any career, you never want to feel trapped. You know, you always want to have a little bit of a sense of uniqueness and challenge there.
Oscar Santiago is on this record with you. He was there with you in Nino for a bit, also Puya. What did it mean to you to bring you in on this, or bring him in on this project? And who else is on the record with you?
Well, Oscar, you know, is one of the best percussion players as far as rock music, metal, and blending any cultural rhythm into that. It was a no-brainer, you know. He had heard a couple of the songs and thought that he could, you know, add something to the project with some of the rhythms. And on the El Nino songs, he really, really shined. I mean, it's phenomenal, some of the stuff that he did on the El Nino songs. And it was a no-brainer, you know. He heard the songs, liked them, and I knew that he would just bring the project to the next level. I didn't want to have like loud drum things on there. I wanted to have a particular vibe, and he's a professional when it comes to emotion through rhythm and percussion. Another musician we got on there is Conrado Pesinato, who's a dear friend of mine. He was the guitar player for Graham Bonnet. You remember the band Rainbow?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So Graham Bonnet was a singer of Rainbow and also of Alcatraz. So Conrado Pesinato played with Graham Bonnet in Alcatraz and in the Graham Bonnet band. He's now working with Zayn Malik, doing some tracks with Zayn Malik. And then Stephen Brewer, who's a metalhead, you know, pretty much. He was in Westfield Massacre. He's on the project as well. And having multiple guitar players and having everybody there at once needed to occur because we were only using a couple of mics. You know, if the album would have had a very singular guitar sound, very singular vocal thing to it, which some songs do more than others, like on Die Alone, I was the only player on it. I played the entire song by myself. Nobody else recorded on it. But on the other songs, they have a little bit more instrumentation. So, you know, everybody needed to play together. And beyond that, we got Junior. Who's an amazing Latin jazz bass player. He's been in the Latin jazz music scene for almost a decade. And then Ali Bello, who's a Venezuelan violin player. And that pretty much makes up most of the whole band right there.
Okay. How many tracks are on this record?
It's 12 tracks, okay. 48 minutes of music. It's the longest album I've ever made in my entire career. It took me to make a solo album to actually put, you know, a large amount of content on an album.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about putting together a a solo release, you know, you and I were bouncing back and forth, putting together this conversation. In fact, at one point you're like, oh, I gotta put together the packaging and I have a deadline for that. Have you agonized over the artwork and everything about this package? Because it's not a group project, it's all on you.
Yeah. I mean, thank God for Jeff at the label, man, you know, because I probably would have thought about everything, you know, and overthought everything way too much. But luckily, the only positive thing that this quarantine stay-at-home orders have kind of allowed me to benefit from is having a little bit more time, you know. So we've been doing, like, the thank yous and credits and lyrics and the album artwork. And it's all the stuff a musician hates to do, you know. It's like all the stuff that, you know, if you're a musician writing songs, you're like, oh, God, really? I mean, do I have to type this stuff out? But yeah, I've gotten a little bit extra time lately to kind of hammer that out. Luckily, we got months to really work it out and do promo on it. And it's a completely different thing than what I'm used to. Wes, I'm used to being in a band where everybody had different ideas and opinions of how things work, and everything was always last minute. Everything was always, nothing was ever on time. Being able to have time and actually have things scheduled properly, and my most important thing would be, thank God I have somebody that I could kind of bounce ideas with, or else I would be overthinking it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Die Alone's going to be the single that's out on May 8th. We got Hollywood and Sycamore, the album, coming out in September of this year. You mentioned the pandemic and obviously being at home. What have you been doing to keep yourself entertained and sane throughout this entire time?
Man, to be honest with you, keeping in contact with friends, laughing, texting, a lot of texting with friends and laughing, just laughing, trying to laugh as much as possible, because it really is such a dark time. And I'll be honest with you, man, I just came out of such a dark time, you know, with everything that was occurring with the band, that I'm trying to see it as a chance to maybe review life and see what is important and what isn't, and keeping in contact with friends as much as possible has really at least allowed me to smile and get through it. You know, I'm extremely concerned for my family because they're in New York. They're in the middle of where all the cases are, but they're doing an amazing job, not really going anywhere, you know. And I'm lucky where I'm at. And the one thing that has kept me sane is the friends, man. You know, laughing, terrible memes.
You know, so, yes.
I mean, terrible memes are getting us through this. I don't think at least if you haven't lost someone to this, terrible memes are getting you through it, you know.
Oh, I can truly admit to it. Even before we jump on this call, I'm in a group message on Facebook, and there have been some bad ones exchanged alone today. And I'm like, really? Really? This is what we've come to? But they're good and funny.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we'd all be so depressed if we couldn't laugh about something.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
And some people that are in the middle of it and going through incredible suffering right now, you know, they probably can't even think of smiling right now. That's the saddest thing, you know, is we should all cherish. If we could for moments a day just at least smile and laugh, we should cherish that, because the rest of the world and a lot of the world right now is going through a lot of suffering.
Absolutely. I want to hopefully shift gears to something that will bring a smile to your face, and just humor me for a second, because I absolutely hate Wikipedia, but I, for some giggles, I went there, and, you know, because Wikipedia is full of misinformation, but there on your sure. Wikipedia page, it said that you were good friends and created a great bond with the folks in Drowning Pool during a Jägermeister tour, and after Dave Williams had passed, the family had given you his mic in respect. Is that actually true, and do you have it still?
Yes, that is actually true.
Okay.
It was the mic stand.
Okay, the mic stand. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, that was when Dave Williams passed away, man, that hit us so hard, because we were on the road with him during the Ozfest, and mm-hmm. we were able to do the Jägermeister tour, you know, a couple of months earlier. We had bonded at that time. I mean, Dave Williams was a guy that came to us when we were hardly beginning. We didn't know anything. You know, we were still trying to figure out how you know, the music industry works. And he was the kind of guy that would get us hotel rooms on the days off because he knew we didn't have the budget for hotel rooms. So, and all he wanted to do was DJ for us. That's all he asked for. Every single day on the Jägermeister tour, he got us a hotel room. But the only stipulation was he had to be the DJ.
Like on the stage or at the hotel room?
At the hotel room, in the hotel room. You know, he had to be the DJ in the hotel room.
All right, so explain to me Dave Williams being a DJ in a hotel room after the show, because I hear so many stories about him and his Jaeger drinking time. So talk me through a night at with Dave Williams in a hotel room.
Definitely a little bit of chaos and definitely a lot of drinking, for sure. And, you know, the music could be anything. A little bit of dancing, too, because Dave Williams, we remember him as, you know, the singer of a rock band who loved extreme metal, you know, but mm-hmm. I mean, we listened to Michael Jackson at the hotel room sometimes, you know, there was a little bit of dancing going on, but always the one thing about Dave Williams, man, is nobody ever felt uncomfortable around them. No one. That guy could not make anyone feel uncomfortable. And when we lost him on the Ozfest, man, it was tough. I mean, we all cried, you know. For a whole day, we all cried. We cried with the guys from Drowning Pool. We cried amongst ourselves. They gave us the mic stand. I used it for several years, and then I retired it. And we flew their backdrop the entire rest of the tour. We flew the Drowning Pool backdrop for the rest of the Ozfest. El Nino did.
That is cool. I didn't know that. That is really cool, man. Well, thank you for sharing those stories and those memories of Dave. Let's wrap up with a couple things here real quick. You know, share one of your favorite memories of your music career. Doesn't matter when or how it happened. Share one of your favorite memories.
One of my favorite memories. Oh, my God. I will never forget. It was one of our first tours. I didn't understand what end of tour pranks were.
Oh, God.
And there's a lot of them. I could give you four quick ones. Okay.
All right.
It was the beginning of our career. One of the first ones was mild. It wasn't that bad. It was the girls from Kitty. We were on a tour, and at the end of the tour, they got pizza delivered to us on stage. I mean, and the venue was sold out. There was at least 600, 700 kids there. And I remember thinking in my head, what the hell is a pizza guy doing on stage? But he wouldn't leave me alone. I had to stop singing the song, Take the Pizza. The band kept playing, but I had to stop singing, Take the Pizza from him because he wouldn't leave me alone.
Did you have to pay the pizza guy?
No, I was paid.
Okay.
Thank God. I didn't have any money in my pocket, dude. Another amazing one was the guys from Drowning Pool. It was on the Jaeger tour. So I don't know if you know, when bands go to venues, they have like food riders where usually bands will get like cut up fruits and vegetables, and then you have like a cold cut tray. You know, usually they have like a big cold cut tray with whatever. So these bastards were, it was the New Orleans House of Blues, and the New Orleans House of Blues, from the VIP dressing rooms, you could overlook the stage. It was a shower of cold cuts, vegetables, and fruit. I don't know what happened after our set, but they had to have needed at least 10 people to clean up the stage. I mean, it was literally, I mean, back then, people didn't really take too many pictures at shows, but I wish somebody would have filmed that, because it literally looked like a shower of cold cuts and fruit. And then I'll give you one last one, which is the worst one.
Okay, the worst one. All right.
The worst one, and you would never expect it from these guys because they are the sweethearts of rock or rap metal. It was the POD guys. So we were on tour in Europe, and it was the end of the tour. And leading up to the last show, we were both playing baby pranks on each other, like just little pranks, you know, like locking each other in the dressing room and waiting, you know, things like stupid little things like that. You know, one time, I think we like put a vibrator on stage while they were playing and set the vibrator off. Like just little, right. Nobody was getting hurt. Nothing got dirty, you know? So one day this was on the last day of the tour. We go to our bus after the show. And all we hear is Mark was our guitar player at the time. All we hear is Mark's coming from the back lounge screaming, like running from the back lounge screaming. And we're like, what happened? What happened? And he goes, the back lounge is full of crickets. The back lounge is full of crickets. These guys basically went and bought 100 crickets, put them in a brown paper bag, snuck on our bus while we were on stage, opened the brown paper bag and let the crickets go in the back lounge of the bus.
This is the final night of the tour.
The final night of the tour. Oh. That was the final night of the tour.
Now you got to drive or fly.
I mean, we collected as many as we could, but I'm certain some crickets got away. There's no way some crickets didn't sneak out somewhere, and there's no way. Luckily, it was the last night of the tour. Nobody had to, like, eat a cricket while they were sleeping.
I was just thinking, like, how did you guys sleep peacefully that night?
Oh, man, we didn't. Straight to the airport, dude. Get us out of this bus. Burn the bus. Burn the bus.
Oh, that poor bus driver then. Oh, because if there's ever an underrated person in the music business, and I know tour managers get so much crap, but bus drivers are the underrated stars of the music business.
Oh, the things they find under mattresses, man.
Oh.
You know, the things they find under mattresses. We don't even want to know what those bus drivers find.
No. They clean the junk. They deal with you. They deal with the artist all the time. Yeah, no. All, completely the most underrated person on the entire tour. That is, yeah.
And their schedules, and not for nothing, but their schedules are hardcore. I mean, one day they could sleep, you know, whatever they want, but the next day they might only be able to sleep 3 hours. And those guys got everybody's life in their hands, you know. It's definitely, you are absolutely right. A bus driver is very underrated. In my band, we always did all we could to make sure we vetted bus drivers.
Yeah, there are some bad ones. You definitely want to make sure you don't get that meth head on the bus to be your driver.
For sure. A couple of times it's occurred. We've had to tell our driver, dude, we smell alcohol on your breath. We're not driving tonight. That's occurred a couple of times.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yikes. Well, I know, unfortunately, touring for a lot of folks is postponed for the time being. But when the time does come that you can head out on the road to go ahead and support Hollywood and Sycamore, what can fans expect when they see you live?
Really cool, vibey production. I'm going to make sure I have a cool mood production that really fits the music. Okay. And not just the songs, but, you know, I think I'm going to do a little bit of storytelling as well and hopefully make people laugh and feel really good about it. We're right now booking a U.S. tour for September, October. Hopefully we could stick to the dates. So, you know, we'll be going around the U.S. in September, October for sure. It may work out to be me and Jarrett from Bowling for Soup doing a co-headline.
Oh, that's cool. And,
yeah. And we'll probably bring another acoustic artist. You know, we're going to try to make it something really good, really good. We want people to feel really good if they come out. And hopefully we'll be able to take them through a wave of emotions. You know, Jarrett's got like a killer show where you get to laugh and feel really good. And then, you know, a lot of the songs that I have are very serious, but I do want to put a little bit of that storytelling and lighthearted element in between songs. But the production will be great and the shows will be great. That's for certain.
Oh, cool. Looking forward to it all. Again, Die Alone coming out on May 8th, and then Hollywood and Sycamore coming out in September. So looking forward to it all. Christian Machado, thank you so much, brother. I really do appreciate the time.
Wes, it has been an honor, dude. And anytime you want to have me on, you let me know, brother. And when we do the tour, we'd love to come by the station and maybe, you know, I could bring by Jarrett with me and we could have a powwow.
Dude, I would love it. And you guys are always welcome. The door is open.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, dude. It really means the world, man. I can't wait to go on tour once that happens.
Hollywood and Sycamore from Christian Machado coming out later this year. Expected in September. That new single, Die Alone, coming out May 8th. So make sure you check that out. Some cool, dark, acoustic metal. I'm Wes Styles. Thanks for checking out the Styles Cast. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Wes Styles Radio for updates on future episodes. And make sure you hit that subscribe button. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.